I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to a new season of Where To Go. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DK Eyewitness.
And welcome to Where To Go, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with the people who know those places best. And it's a new season, Lucy.
We're back. Hooray.
We're back. We haven't been away for that long.
No, it wasn't really a break, was it?
It was about 4 or 5 weeks or so. I don't know what's happened with time. Yeah, so we're back to recording and doing what we do best, which is doing this lovely podcast. But yeah, so welcome to season 6. We have a lot of brilliant destinations lined up for you this season. But Lucy, I thought we'd first start with a little bit of news from ourselves.
Yes, there'll be some new voices, won't there, on the podcast in season 6.
Do not worry, listeners. We are not completely leaving you or anything. But we individually, and by some coincidence, both have had some news. So my wife is pregnant with twins, and Lucy?
I am pregnant with just one. Which, yes.
So confusingly, same hospital, similar time.
Yeah.
We did not plan this.
No, we didn't. But it is eerie, isn't it? I don't think anyone at work or on our wonderful podcast could quite believe it. Could they have retold them?
It was a bit strange. Something in the podcasting waters going on earlier this year. So we will obviously be having a little bit of time out eventually towards the end of the year. Oh, I will be having a little bit of time out. Lucy will be having a bit more time out. So, you know, we love this podcast. We love hosting it. We love meeting our various wonderful guests, and we love speaking with you. And we want to leave the podcast in the safest hands for any time that we're possibly going to be away. So over the next couple of weeks, you will hear a couple of different voices from the DK Eyewitness team. We have lots of they'll be familiar voices. They've been on the podcast before, but we'll be asking a few of our friends to kind of join in to co-host. And yeah, so starting with Zoe next week, who's going to be doing our second episode, which is on Japan. So listen out for that. But yeah, it's really lovely to share this news with you.
It is.
Very weird, Lucy.
It is pretty strange. It's the first time. Well, when does anyone really make a public announcement? It's a bit strange to make a public announcement, but it's also it's really lovely news.
It's lovely news.
Exciting to share it.
A whole new generation of podcasters coming, maybe. I don't know. I'll learn nothing from me. Anyway, so on with the show and on with the season. So as I say, we've got some amazing destinations. We are also heading back to some familiar destinations. So we've been doing the podcast for 3 years now, Lucy.
I know, yeah.
I don't know how that's happened at all.
No.
And obviously 3 years is a long time anyway. For any city, any country, etc. But it's been a very long time with the events of the last couple of years, really, hasn't it?
That's it. Life has really changed, hasn't it? And at the same time, hasn't changed at all. So it's quite an interesting idea to return to some of our favourite destinations, maybe though with a new angle or a new voice, a new perspective, which is really important. So obviously we're talking about Paris this week. We went 3 years ago with Ellie Aldridge, who was a fantastic guest, and that was sort of height of COVID, but things would have changed since then, and we've got someone really exciting to talk to us about Paris this week.
Absolutely. So I would highly recommend going back, listening to that episode of Ellie. I remember lots of things about delivering wine because it was around
COVID.
Right.
Yes, I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. And big hi to Ellie as well. So we are coming back to Paris with a wonderful guide, Lindsay Tremuta.
Yes, so Lindsay Tremuta is a culture and travel journalist and the author of The New Paris and The New Parisienne. She's the host of The New Paris podcast and also conducts tours of the city. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me. Delighted.
Welcome, Lindsay. It's a real honor to have you on the podcast.
It really is.
I'm very excited to be here. Who doesn't like talking about Paris?
Exactly.
Absolutely. What a way to kick off the season. So as usual, we're going to begin with learning a little bit more about our guest, Lindsay, followed by her all-important recommendations on where to go and insider knowledge of Paris. Then we'll hear about upcoming exciting events and ways to make a positive impact when you visit Paris.
So Lindsay, you've been living in Paris, I think, since 2006.
Exactly.
Can you tell us what brought you to the city and also what made you stay?
Well, isn't that the sort of abiding question? What makes you stay in a city like Paris? I mean, I studied French literature and linguistics. So I actually started when I was 12 and then pursued linguistic studies throughout, you know, my higher education. And I kind of always felt like I was born in the wrong place, but that's a very unclear sentiment to try to explain to both, you know, educators and your family. So I didn't know where that would lead me, but I knew that I had a sort of natural, I don't want to say natural gift, but definitely a certain ease with language. And I thought it's kind of a shame to not pursue this in some way. And so that led me to studying abroad a couple of times, the first of which for an extended period of time was in the summer of 2006. And then I made the move kind of official at the end of that year because I began a master's program. And from there, I just essentially never left. And so I stayed because it quickly felt like home. I think I was looking for a bit of what French and, but more specifically, Parisian culture really offers a person. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up living in a super urban environment. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. So definitely a little bit more residential than, you know, metropolis. And I think there was an element that was very exciting to me about having access to culture, the arts, all this food that I had never even heard of before, you know. And so there was a lot of wonder involved. Mm. And then I realized, you know, how am I going to make the French language part of my everyday life unless I'm living in a French-speaking country? And so that kind of led me to the realization that this is going to be the place where I need to try to build a career. And that's kind of how it started. So after the master's, I never left. Well, I didn't leave after my undergraduate degree. And then I pursued the master's and then have been here ever since.
The story continues. Speaking of which, you've authored two books. So you've authored The New Paris and The New Parisienne, all about the trends and influential people that are making France's capital a more exciting place to explore. Can you tell us about some of the areas where Paris is sort of changing rapidly?
Well, you know, I think what has helped me in my work, in my lens on Paris, is that when I first arrived, I was staying in the 13th arrondissement, which is certainly not the most tourist heavy. There are certain landmarks that are interesting to see there, but it's really more residential. It's a bit, you know, far from the center. And then very quickly, I was in the 11th. So for the last 16 years, I've been in the 11th arrondissement, which I've seen completely change and explode. But it still retains a lot of its, you know, intergenerational population, inter-ethnicity. And that's what I love about it. And so my leanings were always, you know, sort of focused on how the eastern part of the city, which was, you know, I think 16 years ago, but certainly before that, would have been considered sort of like the fringes of Paris. That's always the area that interested me. And so those are the areas that I think have developed even further in the time that I've been here. And even just since I've written those two books. So we're talking about the areas of the 19th and the 20th arrondissement, from Belleville all the way up to Les Lilas, areas around Gambetta, certainly other parts of the 18th arrondissement as well. You know, obviously you have Montmartre, which is where the Sacré-Cœur Basilica is, which is iconic, but further west in the 18th around, we tend to think of we tend to speak about Paris by its metro stops. So the Jules Geoffrin section of the 18th arrondissement, you know, also is a very dynamic part of the arrondissement that has radically changed. And same thing with the 17th arrondissement, which technically was a bit beyond my initial purview, but you know, a neighborhood called Batignolles has really exploded in the last handful of years and has both this residential feel and also a lot of interesting restaurants, wine bars, and parks. So I would say, you know, the Left Bank, which, you know, is sort of the iconic tourist trodden part of the city, retains everything that is really wonderful and beautiful about it, but is not where the biggest change has happened.
Yeah.
So the fringes are still where it's perhaps the most interesting.
Yeah. That sounds like London as well, actually. Just thinking...
Oh, that's not surprising.
Yeah, exactly the same. Sort of there's something sort of wonderfully classic about the centre. But as you say, it's those outer neighbourhoods that are undergoing so much change. What is that, Lindsay? Is there something in particular that excites you about Paris, like right here, right now? Is there anything in particular that you're finding incredibly exciting about the city?
Well, I think that the mayor has done a lot of work to make infrastructural changes that I think make living here, in theory, it's supposed to make living here and visiting easier. So, you know, part of that started during COVID with the development of a significant number of new bike routes. So I want to say that, I mean, this could be an incorrect figure, but I think I remember reading something like 400 kilometers of new bike lanes all across the city.
Oh, wow.
And that's continuing even further, a project that's obviously been accelerated a bit because the Olympics are coming in a year.
Yeah.
So infrastructurally, there's a lot that is evolving. So in addition to the bike lanes, a lot of pedestrianization, making certain streets that used to feel like, you know, bustling market streets, but have, of course, been used by cars as well, are now returning to sort of probably what they were meant for initially, which was to be just for pedestrians and bikes and things like that. And greenification projects. And I think all of that is really important as we consider our climate crisis and what it means to visit urban environments in this time and with erratic heat patterns. And the city has had to really think about how to make green spaces part of the plan for the heating, you know, for the city heating up and how you sort of navigate that. But it also means it's more pleasant. I mean, London, as a counterpoint, you have these massive parks that are just so lush, and we actually don't have quite as many. And many of them are very manicured, and they're not meant for sort of like, you know, laying out all day. If you need them to serve that purpose. So I think I'm really excited about some of these urban development projects, because I think they are good for both tourists and for locals. And then I would say there's, out of COVID, you know, all over the world, there's been a shift, especially in the hospitality industry. A lot of people have left the industry, but that also means that the people who really want to build projects in that industry have also found their opportunity. So I feel like there's a lot of new types of restaurants opening. There are even more wine bars or cocktail bars with interesting focuses. I just think there's a little bit more of an exciting energy that, you know, I didn't feel in other cities in the U.S. when I went back after COVID. You know, I think there it felt like, oh, this has been a real tough period. And here I think it was like, let's regroup. And the people who are going to keep creating for Paris are going to find new ways to do that. And I think that's really exciting. So it's not even just in food. It's also in retail, or it's in, you know, the types of spaces that exist. I think there's just a little bit more openness and fun.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because we just obviously want to live in a fun place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Don't ask for much. That's
seems like a basic, but
yeah.
We've all lived through something pretty traumatic. So I think it's good to remember that, you know, the city has the capacity, the city and its people have the capacity for resilience and rebuilding.
It's also very reassuring to hear, because I think we all slightly, you know, worship Paris. The thought of Paris falling, for want of a better word, would be awful. So thank you, Lindsay. That's I'm so pleased to hear that Paris is, you know, not only surviving but thriving, I guess.
It feels that way. I mean, there are obviously there are tensions, especially anytime, as I'm sure for anyone living in big cities, they know that anytime you're pushing big infrastructural projects, you know, there's a lot of griping, a lot of complaining, you know, as the, you know, the growing pains, that whole process of sort of getting adjusted to change. But I think we're headed in the direction we need. And it's good to see that, you know, despite critiques and some roadblocks, that, you know, we're sort of forging ahead.
Cool.
That's great to hear. Let's check out a couple of your key Paris recommendations. So to kick things off on your recommendations, Lindsay, we're going to ask you to give us a quick fire tour of Paris. We're going to name a few categories and you have to suggest just one thing to do. Are you ready?
I am, but this is like an impossible task.
Yes. We get this feedback from guests a lot, but we...
It's okay. I do this too when I interview people, but it's hard when the tables are turned on you.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I could totally. I would find it pretty impossible if I was asked about London, but never mind, maybe one day we'll do that, who knows. But yeah, so just one thing, and there's always a chance to talk about a few more things afterwards. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, great. So we are going to kick off with your favorite view of the city.
So I think the best and broadest view is from the top of the Sacré-Cœur Basilica, but to get there, you have to climb the 300 steps, and that's not exactly accessible for everyone. So as sort of like a modified version, you can get different vantage points on the city, still from the Sacré-Cœur, but, you know, at its base. So without actually going inside and having to go up, and you can even access that with a funicular. And it gives you sort of like a really wide view of the city, gets all the landmarks, you get the rooftops. I think it's quite beautiful. I know you said one, but I am going to sneak in another.
Go for it.
Belleville Park, or the Parc de Belleville, I think is another much smaller way to get a view that does include the Eiffel Tower, and I think is a little bit more unique. But certainly for broad, I would go straight to the Sacré-Cœur.
Wonderful. Two great answers. I think you might find this one tough, Lindsay. Your favorite thing to eat?
Well, this is a question of what is my favorite thing to eat of the moment, because it changes so often.
Yep.
I think I might say the most consistent one are these marinated deviled eggs at the Marie Celeste, which is a really great small plates wine and cocktail bar. And what's so interesting about them is that they also come with pickled onions, a little bit of, oh gosh, what is the herb? There's an herb on top, and also puffed rice. So they're just a really interesting twist on deviled eggs, which are also kind of like a fixture of Parisian bistros, and this is just sort of a refreshing take on them.
Fab.
Okay, the next one is also really, really tricky for Paris, but your favorite thing to drink?
Well, I'm going to go with a category, and you'll let me know if that's appropriate. I was going to say coffee, and I say that because that has historically not always been something that's been good here. But obviously we have a whole specialty third wave, whatever you want to call it, craft coffee scene that is reached, you know, peak maturity, and we have so much good coffee in the city. So if I'm going to remain vague, I'm going to say actually coffee as a drink.
Yes.
And just know that in almost every arrondissement you can find a good coffee spot today.
Do you have a recommend for your favorite, like in your sort of local neighborhood, do you have a favorite coffee shop?
Yeah, I would say that among the best, it's not in my neighborhood, but it's called Motors, and that's in the first arrondissement, and it's very close to the river. It's close to the Pinault Collection, which is a private art museum, and it is really exceptional. The owners have competed in, you know, coffee competitions. It's definitely not very French looking, but the owners are very much French and are very much obsessed with really exquisite coffee. And then in terms of one that might be a little bit more French in terms of a vibe, I would say the Dancing Goat, which is actually owned by an Englishman who's been in France a long time. And that's in the 20th. And the space is just absolutely gorgeous. You just want to sit there and read all day. It's quite big. And they do excellent coffee as well.
Great.
That's worth breaking the format for.
Totally. I knew James would pick me up for that, but I couldn't resist asking. And I will be Googling that afterwards because it has the best coffee shop name ever. The Dancing Goat. I love it. Lindsay,
it's lovely.
your favorite day activity?
If it's not walking around the city, which is just, you know, a pure delight, it would be reading in the Palais Royal Gardens, which is one of my favorite spots in the entire city.
Perfect.
Wow. Lovely. Perfect. And then finally, you are acing this round, by the way. Your favorite, God, this is going to be so tricky with Paris, museum or gallery?
I really like the Carnavalet Museum. It's the History of Paris Museum, essentially. So it's where you'll find, I mean, it is bursting with paintings, sculptures, artifacts, but even old signage. I mean, it's also a free museum. So right in the heart of the Marais, I think it's a really beautiful museum. It was renovated. So I want to say it's only been a couple of years that it's been reopened. They have a beautiful courtyard. And they do also host temporary exhibits. So it's always worth seeing what's on there. And it's a beautiful spot.
Great. Well, I think you passed that with flying colours. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to sort of Paris, sort of zoom out slightly, Paris more generally. It's obviously such a well-known city, but sort of beyond the obvious, what are some highlights that listeners really shouldn't miss when they're visiting?
I think there's the temptation to sort of check a bunch of boxes, and especially culturally, to go to all the big museums, the Louvre, mm-hmm. or the Musée d'Orsay. But I know, as a traveler who feels very overwhelmed by that prospect, even in other cities, that a city like Paris is a perfect place to sort of scale back. So if you're kind of overwhelmed by all the art to see, you can head towards smaller museums or house museums. So these were, you know, artists' former homes that were transformed usually just before their death or just after into museums and sort of recreated almost just as they were left by the artist. So one that comes to mind is the Gustave Moreau Museum, and it really is small collection, really iconic paintings, and then that the space itself is worth seeing on its own. So I think this is a city that excels at all these smaller institutions. And if you're into galleries, you know, there's plenty of that too. A lot of international contemporary art galleries have opened sort of offshoots in Paris. So it's an interesting time depending on what kind of art you like. But I think the broad answer is to say you don't have to go big and blockbuster. Yeah. And I think that's something some people miss because they assume you have to do Paris in a certain way. And I think that's a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think you have to really ask yourself what kind of experience you know you like best in other cities and replicate that in Paris.
We mentioned a little bit about sort of like cycling lanes and stuff before. Is Paris quite an easy city to kind of walk around, to cycle around, to kind of not necessarily always have a plan and kind of like just start to explore?
Absolutely. I mean, this is where we get the term flâneur or flâneuse, if we're going to make it properly inclusive as it should be. But you know, this idea of it being the perfect city for an actual wander, so wandering really with no pressure of a time constraint, no destination in mind, and really just with the idea of exploring and seeing what kinds of like slices of life you observe in doing so. Mm. Biking obviously has become super easy. It doesn't mean it isn't without potential risk because we have a surge of, you know, new cyclists who are on the road and some of them don't follow rules. And so I would say if you are going to cycle in Paris, just be mindful, go maybe a bit slower. You might be an experienced cyclist in your own city, but you know, this is a different city. We have certain, you're supposed to respect, you know, normal road rules, you know, so car traffic, you know, you're supposed to know all these things, but there is no real education campaign that's been done. So you get a lot of people who are like, I know how to ride a bike. It's fine. So just, you know, keep your wits about you, I would say. But this is definitely the ideal city to walk in, to stroll.
Lovely. That's brilliant. As someone who's been living in Paris for like almost 20 years now, you must also have a few best kept secrets, I'm guessing, that you might be willing to share with our listeners.
I mean, it's, you know, it's funny. This one is not even like a true secret, but I just think that visitors don't take the time to come see it. And it's the Butte Chaumont Park.
Okay.
It's in the 19th, okay. And it is absolutely one of my favorite parks. There are a lot of people who run there. There are families. There's plenty of spots to picnic. I've had a number of birthday picnics there. And it actually has, you know, levels. So, I mean, you could be on a flat area and then walk up to more of a peak and get also another view of the city. And so there's really a lot to see and do in there. And there's a really fantastic energy. I mean, if you're looking for something that's like, where do the locals go? They go there. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I would say don't overlook, if you're someone who likes parks, don't overlook the Butte Chaumont.
Great tip.
Great suggestion.
Any other secrets, Lindsay?
The one that comes up a lot is a street that has very colorful facades. It's close to the Gare de Lyon train station and it's Rue Crémieux. But what I would say is actually the secret is the residents don't want people walking on it and taking photos anymore. So if you've seen that on other lists, and I know it still gets published even in 2023, yep, as sort of a secret gem, the secret actually is you shouldn't go and, you know, take selfies on this street because it really has become, you know, another one of those like over-touristed, yeah, zones. So, I mean, if you want to go and like walk through, you know, discreetly, sure. But, you know, the idea of travelers who would take full on, you know,
yes,
take their selfie sticks and do photo shoots.
Yes.
Yeah, no more.
Listeners, that's it. Pay heed, please. Don't yes, be that person.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention because, you know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, yes, it is special, but it's, there are people who actually live there.
Yeah.
And I think we need to remember that. I'm sure in like Notting Hill, totally, that has happened.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The outside of Borough Market with,
yes,
yeah, there's certain spaces where you just can't move through because people are taking selfies.
Exactly.
It's tricky. So, yeah, that's a really, really good tip.
While we're talking about things to do, Lindsay, obviously, other than being a journalist and author and podcaster, you conduct food, coffee, wine shop tours. So without giving the whole game away, could you give us a flavour of what we might do on one of your tours?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what I do is, it really is sort of an opportunity to spring off from my books. So, you know, certainly the base was the New Paris, because it's a way in specific neighborhoods to really bring it to life and have people taste things and not just, you know, and to see some of these spaces in connection with more classic spaces and how these newer spots or innovative spots have helped shape a neighborhood or also bring in new energy and what it means for a neighborhood. So that could mean having a full-on coffee tasting with an idea of why coffee has historically been so terrible in Paris, and actually all of France, but, you know, really speaking.
I had no idea about this, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought the French would be amazing at coffee everywhere.
No, I mean, if you were to show up at your, you know, you're staying at a hotel and there's like a normal corner cafe, chances are it's going to be made from beans purchased by a wholesaler. It's not, you know, they're not specialized. It's not, the person making the coffee is not an expert at coffee. There isn't the idea that it's a fresh product. It's not treated as a fresh product. So there is a story to tell there, and also sort of how we think of cafes, but cafe is both a space and the word for coffee. And so there's really a distinction to be made between coffee as the drink and the cafe as a third space.
Yes. Yes.
So we kind of go into that on the tour and then try all sorts of different sweets and sort of why they're important to the changing patisserie evolution in the city. We talk about natural wine. We can also talk about craft beer, because all of these items, so to speak, have a story.
Yeah.
They have a story, but they also have sort of a different story than they might in another city,
yeah,
you know? Mm-hmm. And obviously, in the case of natural wine, France was one of the pioneering countries in natural wine back in the 60s. And so there are very key places also within Paris that it started to develop before it became sort of for lack of a better word, trendy or part of a bigger movement. So being able to identify sort of the birthplace and then how it has evolved, I think for people who have been to Paris before, makes for a certain, you know, type of experience that they might not get otherwise. Mm. And it's really also about sort of my view. We also go into places that aren't about food, you know, along the way, you know, shops that are part of the story. But I've been surprised that there have been even first timers who were happy to have this lens on the city because maybe they wouldn't have chosen to come to this particular neighborhood on their own. And so it's a way to just see something else in addition to sort of the highlights.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I mean, you often think of like Paris as like, I don't know, and you think of tradition, you think of grandeur, you think of like the whole history of the city as one of Europe's great cities. You don't necessarily think about the last like 30 to 50 years and like kind of what's changed and what's gone on and how it's at the forefront of like, you know, changing Europe's tastes and stuff.
No, absolutely. And I think that was also really one of the motivators of my first book was to say we keep presenting Paris as this sort of postcard destination that doesn't change and that does it a disservice because it actually is changing, perhaps at a different pace than other cities. And so there's always that desire to compare it to faster moving cities like London or New York or Tokyo or whatever. But also Paris was always sort of an innovator and to really look back in its history and to show how this stage we're in now is not unprecedented. It's just that there was some moments in the middle where maybe they were, you know, whether it was in food or architecture or arts, it was sort of, you know, resting on its laurels. But it's not a city that really is immobile. And I think it gets that reputation. Mm-hmm. And the media often doesn't help that portrayal. Film also plays a role in upholding some of these old ideas.
This kind of romantic old notion of Paris.
Yeah. But the thing is that still exists and you can find that and you can find it with the new as well. And so that's actually what I find so fascinating and compelling about this city is that you have all of that old. You can access that and then, you know, an hour later go see something that's completely fresh and new and realize that it's based on and honors an old tradition.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Paris has really, I think, tried to do very well. And maybe there are other European cities that have excelled at this. But all I can say is that that often gets lost in the story of Paris. I think because the easy clickbaity thing is just to, you know, go back to what's tried and true. And I don't think that is necessarily what makes it such an interesting place today.
That's a really good way of just, as you say, looking at different cities, but looking beyond the obvious in Paris.
Exactly.
As well. I think here we're all about kind of like, yeah, enabling travelers to kind of like have the best time in not always the expected ways as well. So
because you can do both. You can do the expected, but you can also do the unexpected. And if you combine the two, you'll probably have an even more enriching experience.
Absolutely. And I think that is a wonderful moment to just end that section on because it was brilliant. It's so good. And I really want to go on one of your tours.
Me too. It sounds amazing.
Come on down.
Oh, yeah. If you're keen to explore another side of the City of Light, Paris Like a Local is a book for you. You'll discover the small businesses and community strongholds add character to this vibrant city, recommended by true locals. Find Paris Like a Local in all good bookshops or via the link in our episode bio.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Lindsay, we have to touch on the Olympics next year. What's the mood like in Paris? Are people excited?
Oh, yes. I mean, the you know, it's we've gone through a whole spectrum of emotions. I think it's been sort of like, oh, that's actually happening sooner than we realized. Okay. There's been frustration because in the beginning of this year when they opened the drawing for tickets, so, you know, you would enter to be able to get like sort of...
kind of ballot kind of thing.
Yeah, like a lottery almost to get, you know, an opportunity to bid or to purchase sort of the earliest tickets. We realized that the pricing, you know, what a shock, is not as accessible as they made it sound it was going to be. You have to buy groups of tickets. So I think there was a bit of frustration. There was some backlash, I think, to the pricing model. But now we are, I mean, we're almost to the fall, which means this very week, actually, which just ended yesterday, was the test trials in the Seine for the triathletes, both for the Olympics and the Paralympics. And what's huge about that is, as I'm sure maybe some listeners have read, they are really working to make the Seine clean enough for the athletes to swim in. And then thereafter, for there to be zones that even the public will be able to swim in. I mean, it's been, I think, I want to say 100 years since people have been able to swim in the Seine because of poor water quality and pollution. And so what they're doing is they're building this sort of reservoir basin that will collect the rainwater, because it seems like that's really the problem. You get this rainwater that then spills over into the Seine and then the water quality declines. But if they can sort of hold that separately and then purify it or filter it or whatever the mechanism is, then it should be okay for next year. They're still working on that sort of reservoir situation, but it was clean enough for at least up until Saturday for the athletes to do the swimming portion of the triathlon in. Apparently, that was not true for the Paralympic test trials. They had to cancel the swimming stage for water quality reasons. So there's a lot of attention on what's happening in terms of just the center of the city. And that's not even where the games will be mostly taking place. But the opening ceremony for the first time in Olympic history will take place outside of a stadium. So there's the event is going to be in the center of the city along the Seine. That is huge security issue. So we're all also sort of like, how is this going to work? But we do have sort of a test run, so to speak. In September of this year is the World Rugby Championship. And I think that, you know, they're hoping to use that as like a rehearsal. On a much smaller scale, but certainly some sort of like a dress rehearsal. And so we'll see what that leads to. But the Seine is definitely a focus, and you'll have different swimming events, but the opening ceremony specifically. And I think there's I think that is what the energy is focused on right now, and then we'll see sort of as the year progresses. But we also did learn that the booksellers, you know, the bouquinistes, which are the iconic booksellers along the riverbanks with the green boxes, that the police have, I think, asked many of them to move during at least the opening ceremony, if not the entire games, for security reasons. And I think that's, you know, there's some complicated feelings around that as well. I mean, the bookseller as a presence in that spot has been in Paris for like 400 years. And so, you know, if you're coming to the Olympic Games and you're coming to Paris, you sort of want the full picture of this city. So, you know, I think it's a wave of emotions about this, the arrival of the Olympics, which I'm sure London felt. I remember watching the London Olympics on a big screen in front of City Hall in Paris. So I know that it's a complicated endeavor, but as of right now, I think at least there's some hopefulness given the success of these, or partial success of the swimming trials in the river, that maybe they will pull this off. But I think the idea of how many people will come to the city next summer is a bit daunting. Yep. So as a local, I'm like, wow, how is this going to work?
It's very eerily similar to London 2012. I kind of remember being like, oh, wait, wow, this is round sooner than I expected. Yes. And how is this going to work? I think lots of people were quite skeptical about how it would work as well and the infrastructure.
But then got swept along with it and just found themselves, you know, I'm totally addicted. And I wonder whether the same is going to be the case for most of Paris.
Oh, I believe so. I mean, I think, you know, because it takes so long and there are so many preparations, there's too much time for your mind to start, you know, going into those skeptical directions. But, you know, they are putting a lot of thought into this, and hopefully, you know, there's so many buildings that are being reused as well.
Nice.
I was going to ask about this. Is there kind of like a legacy thing as well, where they're kind of repurposing older sites and changing up different bits of the city?
Absolutely. The Stade de France, which you might know as sort of like our leading stadium, is going to be used. The Paris des Princes, which is where the PSG football team plays, is being used, in addition to plenty of other, arenas or zones. But what's interesting also, and I don't know if this was the case when London hosted, there are a lot of events and disciplines that will take place across France. And you'll have, you know, football in Lille, Nantes, Marseille, Lyon. You'll have sailing in Marseille. Cool. You'll have surfing in Tahiti. It's going to be really interesting. And I think, you know, maybe that's also a way to sort of boost the country and not just Paris.
Yeah.
But certainly there's a lot of novelty involved in what's coming. And I think Paris wants to be the first to do a lot of these things. So maybe they will be successful. And then we will remember this experience as being, you know, a more positive one. But we'll see. You know, I know there are going to be some disruptions next year. You know, the Tour de France will not, for the first time in its history, finish at the along the Champs-Élysées.
It will
have to be moved because of the timeline of preparing the city for the Olympics. Same thing with, I think, the July 14th Bastille Day events will also take place in a different location. So, you know, it does disrupt certain annual fixtures of the programming, but it's for a good reason.
Yeah.
Totally. You have actually mentioned this. We've mentioned Rugby Tour de France, for instance. Are there any other, and Bastille Day, are there any other events to mark on Paris's calendar, sort of the end of this year or next year? Or is it really all about the sport?
It really, I have to say, I think it really is focused on the sports. As we said, rugby coming in September, which is, a big draw for a lot of people. You also have all of the usual fashion calendar, which, you know, always seems to conflict with other cultural events, and I'm not yet sure how some of those events will change, because, you know, Fashion Week seems to happen every 2 days, and so, you know, that will conflict potentially with, you know, some of the start of the Olympic activities. So concerts, festivals, you know, there are all these music festivals also that take place throughout the spring and summer, and I think there's some question as to when they will be moved to, how they will be moved. So really the focus, as you can tell as a result, is really sports and hosting this, because I don't think they could really focus their attention on too many other things, to be honest. I mean, this is like so gargantuan that one heavy lifting project at a time.
That's pretty understandable.
Completely fair point, yes.
I think, like, we've touched on some of this next question a little bit beforehand in terms of some of your tours and kind of the impact of how people can see Paris differently. But this season, we're exploring how listeners can support local communities while traveling. And Paris is one of the most visited cities on Earth. But what sort of things can travelers think about to ensure that they're supporting locals when visiting?
I think already, if you're staying in a neighborhood that is not sort of known as a tourist quarter, and by that I mean where there's just hotels and, you know, designer stores, then you're probably going to be in an area where there's a lot of independent stores, maybe even some locally made products, whether that's in food or fashion or accessories. And I think trying to choose those neighborhoods and then support the businesses that are in those areas is already going to be more helpful than if you just sort of dip into one neighborhood where there are these independent shops and then go back to your sort of, you know, more homogenized part of town. I think really basing yourself in an area like that can do a lot of good, and it can open you up to all sorts of other businesses, and you start talking to the shop owners who are going to say, you should go see my friend who does this over here. I think it opens you up to a lot of interesting connections and encounters, and then supports local business. Then the other thing I would say is Paris does suffer from, you know, moments of over-tourism. We have huge events coming, with the exception of the Olympics. I mean, because I know that's a very special and exceptional moment. I would say also think about coming in off moments. I know we say this about Venice. We say this about even Rome and Barcelona. You know, if you can have the flexibility to come outside of sort of the big vacation chunks that seem to bring in the most people, like the summer months of July and August, or like, I don't know, spring break, you know, try to do so, because not only will you have a better experience, but it does allow the city to better manage, I think, the flow of people and the experience that they can offer.
Yeah. I think that's very important with next year in mind as well, when who knows what's going to happen.
Truly. Like, if you do not care about the Olympics, do not come in the summer. Yeah. Like, already get that in your head right now. Like, that's not going to be the prime moment to come. And luckily, there are going to be a lot of infrastructural changes that you'll benefit from if you come before or after. But I would say, you know, that has to be in the mind of a traveler. At least I would hope that they know that this is sort of like, this is going to be all consuming. And if you really do not, you know, if you can change your dates and you really do not care about sports, this is not the time to come to Paris. So I think it's important to, you know, really, really tailor your experience and your travel, I guess, itinerary around the notion of this is going to be a big year for Paris. See how you can adjust if you do intend to come.
I think that's a really, really, really great point to end on. Great piece of advice for listeners. Thank you so much, Lindsay. There's so much more we could talk about with you that we can't just fit into one podcast.
You have to come back.
With pleasure, anytime.
Absolutely. But listeners can also check out your podcast as well and subscribe to the New Paris podcast on iTunes and Spotify for way more about all things Paris. But it's been so wonderful to have you on the podcast, Lindsay.
Thank you. Thank you. A bientôt.
So a huge, huge thank you to Lindsay again. As I just mentioned, you can subscribe to the New Paris podcast everywhere you get your podcasts. Highly recommend it. She's a brilliant travel voice repping all things Paris. And it was just a real honour to have her on the pod, right, Lucy?
It really was. And genuinely the best start to this season. So thank
Absolutely.
You so much, Lindsay.
Yeah, for sure. And you can follow Lindsay's work as well at lindsaytramuta.com. And I loved going back to Paris. I mean, I think I said in the last time we did Paris, I was really keen to go and desperate to go. I still haven't been in 3 years, obviously.
Me neither.
and given what we said at the top of this episode, probably not going anytime soon. No. But Lindsay has really brought all the feels with it, and I'm so excited to go back at some point. So thank you so much, Lindsay. As we said, we've got a whole new season of exciting new destinations for you. So in the next fortnight, we'll be heading to Japan with Todd Fong.
Yes, and I am leaving you in the very capable hands, James, of my pal and fellow senior editor, Zoe Rutland. She will be filling in my shoes.
Yes, absolutely. And she's been working on the new edition of Be More Japan. So
with Todd, so it makes sense.
I'm sure Zoe will do a brilliant, brilliant job in your absence, Lucy. But then Lucy will be back for loads of episodes for the rest of the season. Don't worry, listener.
You're not getting rid of me yet. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we shall see you then in a fortnight. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And we shall see you very soon. Where to Go is a podcast from DK Eyewitness. It was produced by Julia Baker, presented by Lucy Richards and James Atkinson with the help of Bella Talbot. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness. And please like and follow the show. And if you have time, leave a review. Your support means so much to us.